minutes after 12 o'clock, and here's two guys that are having way too much fun already. Ribbing me about my astrological report on K-Dove. And, of course, you know, this is all from Psalm 19.
We love you, Pat.
You know.
Now, how is your astrology report from Psalm 119?
It is not an astrology report.
Well, you were
just saying what's
up
there.
The Gemini up there.
Gemini. Well, that is the name of a constellation.
It is, you know.
Well, he has me there.
He does indeed.
And Saturn is in it right now.
So the question is the moon in the seventh house and Jupiter aligned with Mars?
All of that stuff comes from a long time ago.
Okay.
No, but
this has almost nothing to do with Christian
history.
You know
right?
That.
There are 12 constellations around the path of the sun.
You see what you've got
and
him all
so
on?
Now, you My know, goodness. That's where, since we're all on the same plane with the planets move back and
this
forth.
This reminds
that
me of
same
a funny
plane,
story, but
it's called
we
the
don't
ecliptic,
have time.
And so you can go where the planets are right there in those various constellations, and Saturn happens to be in Gemini. And
hey,
I've
how
gone
about
way
those Cubs Saturday? That was
yeah,
a heck of
really,
a game, wasn't
that
it?
Was.
Hey, you know what? Sammy Sosa's going to be playing for the O's this year. What do you think about that?
Oh, my
Well, you
goodness.
Guys have really gone far afield from
I know.
Something.
You're going to talk about a really great guy,
we're
too.
Gonna talk about, we're talking about Francis Schaeffer, Pat.
An amazing human being.
Amazing human being, 1912 to 1984. So somebody in recent history. You know, one of the patterns, Pat, that we see in the Scripture as we see God working out his story with humanity is that he raises up men and women that are equal to the tasks of their time.
Yes.
Sort of reminiscent of Mordecai, you know, and his charge to Queen Esther, you know. Who knows, in essence, who knows if you weren't born for such a time as this? And that is certainly true with Francis Schaeffer. The 20th century, without too much deep examination, is easily probably one of the most darkest times in human history thus far, one of the most darkest centuries. And Francis Schaeffer was a man that God raised up to speak light into that darkness. Now, Newsweek called Francis Schaeffer the guru of fundamentalism. And he didn't look like your typical guru, but Francis Schaeffer's appearance was a bit eccentric. He had long hair. He wore long hair, bald on top and long on the back. Never did the comb-over thing, I guess. And he wore a goatee long before it was in fashion. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, there was the trademark knickers and high socks. Which
like I'm wearing today.
Exactly, like the knickers and socks that you're wearing today. And he wore it no matter what the occasion. It was kind of an eccentric look.
Well, he was Swiss.
He wasn't Swiss.
He wasn't.
No, he lived in Switzerland, but he wore it even when he was in America. I mean, it
really?
Just kind of...
Really? I see. All right. Well, then that is kind of a...
It kind of became the Franz Schaeffer look. And anyway, he was a bit of an eccentric-looking person. And another one of his really odd eccentricities was the fact that even though his teaching was thoroughly Christian, he rarely ever quoted from Scripture. He was not a Bible verse... Here's a guy that had a degree in theology and was very well educated. Very rarely in his teaching did he ever quote actual verses out of the Bible. He was actually just as comfortable using a secular illustration to make a point as he was using any sort of sacred thing. And he had an encyclopedic knowledge of history that enabled him to put together all sorts of different events and really help people to see the course of the river and the flow of human history and the way it was going.
It's hard to do. It's hard to see those patterns, Pat. We try and do that in our history class, too. But you need to get your fingers on so much information to do that.
Yeah,
and
sure.
One of the problems, then we'll look at that this a little more, is when you paint with such big, broad brush strokes as Francis Schaeffer did, sometimes you end up sacrificing detail. I mean, it's almost inevitable. And so he underwent some accusations for that. But overall, when it's all said and done, looking at it, what now, 20 years after his death, the 50 of...
Yeah, almost 30 years after
his
death. Wow,
50-year anniversary of his shelter at Labrie. He came down and accurately predicted some
amazing
things in his work. So it's really interesting. It's now kind of funny that he was born just a poor kid in Pennsylvania, grew up in a working-class family. You know, his dad taught him all kinds of construction techniques. So he's in there wiring and plumbing and pounding nails. And his family is not – they weren't very Christian, were they?
They went to church out of respectability, but mm-hmm. they really – really had no faith to speak
of. So he had some familiarity with the Bible, but not really.
They went to a liberal mm-hmm. Presbyterian church, okay. a real nominal thing, and it was something that people did in 1912 to look respectable.
And his working class folks were not, they were kind of anti-intellectual. They knew some, you know, teachers and professors that were kind of the ivory tower thing and weren't really connected to the reality that a working person knows. And so they were very eager for Francis to avoid this. So when one of his teachers sent back a report card that said, you know, this kid's got some serious intellectual gifts, they just ignored it. And
actually, they concealed it from him.
Oh, did they really?
They actually concealed that letter from him because they didn't want Francis to get any ideas that he might be
you know, I think that's what my
really
folks
smart.
Did.
I'm almost certain that's exactly what your folks did, Matt. That's certainly. Well, you know, once again, though, we have these pivotal moments in our life. I want you to think of Francis Schaeffer now as a teenage boy attending church. And he was asked by somebody at the church if he wouldn't mind tutoring a Russian man to help him learn how to
speak English.
And Francis took on the job and actually had ordered a book that he was going to use to tutor this man. And the bookseller inadvertently and actually quite accidentally gave him a book on Greek philosophy. And Francis started reading this book on Greek philosophy and how it addressed the big questions of life.
Wow.
And it was like a major turning point in his life. He couldn't get enough of this.
What a coincidence. Almost as though some unseen hand of an omnipotent power. Never mind.
We know. Too far gone. But anyway, Francis begins to look at philosophy as what we need, you know, to find the answers in our life. And he would have probably given up Christianity, except one of the things he had a commitment to was truth. And Francis decided that before he was going to totally give up any vestige of Christianity in his life, that he at least ought to read the Bible one time through from cover to cover. And you'll never guess what happened. He read that, and he started to find that the Bible answers some of the most foundational questions of life. Where we come from? What are we supposed to do? Where are we going? And it was like the light really went on in his life. And he began to trust that the Bible was filled with the truth that mankind truly needed.
So we're talking about 1928, 930, right
mm-hmm, here? Yeah, before World War II, say early 30s, Depression era.
Okay, because he was born in Pennsylvania in
1912,
you said?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Germantown, Pennsylvania is where he came from.
Right outside of Philadelphia.
Right there out of Philly, that's right. So.
Well, you know, the long and the short of this is he decides, you know, I don't want to go to engineering school. I want to go to seminary. Well, you can imagine how his folks took this, and he was so beat up by it and feeling like he folks wishes that, what, didn't he do, didn't he flip his coin?
He was in conflict with his father about going to a Christian college, going to a seminary of any kind. They wanted him to go to technical school. He goes down the basement and he says, Lord, before I go up there and go to battle with my dad, I've got to know for a fact that this is where you want me to go. And so he took a coin out of his pocket and he says, if it's heads, you win. If it's tails, dad wins. Flips the coin, heads. He says, all right, one more time. Now this time, if it's tails, and he does tails, and it comes up tails. He says, okay. You know, not to be obtuse about... Is that the right word, obtuse?
Absolutely.
Okay. I wanted to throw an extra word in tonight.
I'm proud.
Or today, or whenever this is.
Mm-hmm.
My Sudafed's kicking in, so I'm a little off today. Anyway, he flips a coin now a third time, and it's heads. And God wins three coin tosses in a row. Man, that Sudafed's really caught me today. Anyway, he wins that, and God wins, and when God wins... We all win.
The rest is history. Well, the long and the short of it is, although we don't recommend this method for determining God's will in your life.
It worked for Gideon.
Yeah, that's right. Basically, he did. He suffered his parents' wrath and convinced them that, no, he needs to go off to seminary. And he did. He went off to seminary at a very pivotal time. This is when liberalism was first really infecting the schools.
1935.
And he really felt compelled to hang tough with an orthodox view. And as a matter of fact, he met his wife. when they both stood up at the same time in a debate to defend orthodoxy in a big student debate, and ended up getting married to her and really admired her, graduated from seminary a couple years later, I guess spent the war years just being a pastor in Pennsylvania and Missouri, and kind of, you know, you don't, with Francis Schaeffer, you know, you get this idea of the international philosopher, and it's kind of funny to picture him as a little, you know, podunk pastor in the Midwest, you know, just tooling around in the farm fields and all.
You know, that was one of the things, though, that was a hallmark of his ministry in those first 10 years. He and his wife, Edith, worked in Pennsylvania, in Missouri, and they just worked with humble working-class congregations. And one of the hallmarks of Francis Schaeffer's work with his congregations is when he ministered to them and called on them frequently, he did it over doing chores with them or home fixer-upper projects, and it enabled him to really relate to the people in a real way. And, of course, he was a man that believed working with your hands had a lot of dignity to it, even though he was, even at this early age, really a great thinker. You know, it'd also be a mistake to not mention here, and this is something, once again, jumping ahead to somebody's limelight years. He and Edith actually are known best in the early years as having quite a ministry to children. And it's kind of hard to think of Francis Schaeffer as a kid's ministry, you know, doing flannel graphs and hay rides and hot dog roasts with teenagers and all that stuff. But that is exactly what he and his wife did, and actually became very, very well known and very good at it. And that was how they ended up even going to Switzerland the very first time. They developed this ministry called Children for Christ, which later grew to be a national ministry in the United States. And they were actually sent out to do a few things in
Europe. His church was set up with the International Council of Christian Churches. And after World War II, Francis and Edith were doing such a great job with their ministry that the International Council said, come over. A lot of devastation over here. Survey the war-torn countries. You know, see what kind of application for your ministry program you might have.
Expand the work with children over in war-torn Europe.
So they do. Once again, God's hand is at work here. He establishes the Schaeffer family there in Lausanne, Switzerland. And over the next few years, they're running their ministry program pretty well. It's all working pretty good. But the funny thing that's going on is Francis and Edith both are being exposed to this vast reservoir of European thought, both secular and sacred, and European art, which just really takes hold of Francis's imagination. We're going to see that later.
Especially being shut out of art galleries because of his upbringing.
Oh, yeah. It just, you know,
What's that about?
Well, first off, we don't have much exposure to art over here, not the way that continental Europe has got it. I mean, there, you know, museums everywhere. Our use of museums for art is actually a little bit more recent than most of us tend to think. And, you know, the access to a Depression-era pastor ministering in the rural areas was not very high.
But he was barred from...
Because of his parents, his upbringing. They did not want him...
They didn't take him to...
They did not want him involved in anything that might be, you know, a foo-foo kind of thing. I mean, it was strictly, you know, we want you to grow up and be you know, work with your hands. Anything like that. Anything of the intellect was very much frowned upon in his home.
So as his intellect grew and he's gaining more and more knowledge just about, you know, philosophy, art, its application in the midst of this completely devastated, smoking ruin of a continent following World War II and the suffering that's going on in the streets all around him, we find Francis is deposited. He's about 40 years old here. That's maybe 1947, 48. He enters into a year-long period of what can really best be described as the long night of the soul. You know, he's wrestling with contradictions. He's really having trouble making sense of how best his Christianity, his faith should be lived out. And over time, he actually arrives at one of the things that will shape his life from now on, is that the intellect and the orthodox belief that's available by an understanding of the mind must be wedded to the passion of the experiential nature of Christianity. You have to love people. You can't just understand them. You've got to love them. And whatever your Christianity says, no matter how orthodox it is, it must be demonstrated by love.
Gee, that sounds a lot like what Jesus said.
You know, it's a coincidence.
Love the Lord your God with all your heart, your soul, your mind, your strength, and love your neighbor, says yourself. If you're not doing that, What are you doing with
That is one of the that is one of the problems with 20th century Christianity, and definitely at this particular point in the history of the church, there was really more of a greater emphasis on adherence to the right ideas, not so much adherence to the practice of those
ideas.
Because
remember, the church was under attack by all the liberal ideas, so it was that was the rise of fundamentalism. Was it very important to get in our minds what we actually believe? And that was a great thing. That was important.
We mustn't ever decry believing in sound doctrine. But sound doctrine needs to be wedded to sound practice.
Amen.
Good for you.
Well, good for Francis. I tell you, a lot of these ideas seem common to us today, but it was he that tended to codify and bring a lot of these things into focus. Well, you know, basically, I resolved his spiritual confusion, and it's funny, in talking about the program beforehand, we kind of split his life up into various periods, you know, his pilgrim period when he's really searching for his purpose and meaning as a young man, his pastor period when he's, you know, just doing his regular pastoring in the Midwest and moving to Switzerland. But resolving the spiritual crisis is when he really begins to move into the period that we would characterize as perhaps Francis as a philosopher,
where he begins taking the things he's learned and he's made them really, you know, begins outlining them as a way to live your life, and it really moves into, because he becomes now roughly around 1955. He has this Dark Night of the Soul in the early 50s, 55. He and his wife, Edith, are looking for some new avenues of ministry. They've been doing a little of this, a little of that. They've been faithful to what they've been called, but they really are looking for something new. And it starts with the weekend. Their eldest daughter, by this time, is away at college, and she brings home some of her college friends who are really struggling with some of the big questions in life, and struggling with the idea of God, and you know, is faith real? And she brings home her friends, and Francis basically lavishly spends the weekend over lunch, over walks, listening to them, talking to them, hearing their questions, their concerns, and then explaining in a way that really helps them to connect the idea that historic Christianity actually does have within it the answers in life. And this leads to the forming of a whole nother ministry, which we call L'Abri, which is a French word for shelter. And this initial weekend just continues to develop. It's interesting because Schaefer later said that it was never really intended to be an evangelistic ministry to the young or an evangelistic ministry to dropouts or drugs or intellectual. It was just he and his wife had a commitment to God. They'd been praying about this and made a commitment to God that they would do whatever it took to make the existence of God real to this up-and-coming generation. And that was their big thing, was they wanted to see God working through them and in their ministry in a way that God would be real and would be demonstrated to the up-and-coming generation.
You know, one of the things that made him so attractive to the youngsters is also that this is a guy not overly bothered by, you know, wearing a three-piece suit and filling all the formal the behaviors of a church-going kind of guy. One of the great stories is one of the youngsters who now, I forget, is a major Christian writer now, one of the youngsters that was there, they got into this big, long discussion about evolution, and Francis takes half an hour while his soup is getting cold and gives this awesome dissertation, this full A to Z treatment of why evolution doesn't hold together and why it's doomed to failure. And at the end, everybody's done with their soup and they're all in awe of this answer. But, you know, this youngster that's telling the story is kind of wondering, well, what's he going to do now? He's starving to death. And Francis just reached down in two gulps, puts the soup away, not in Emily Post fashion, let's say. But the youngster was just tickled to death by this, this is not a fondue kind of guy.
No, he really connected with them, and you know, his love and his thinking and the atmosphere they created was one of love and acceptance.
And his weird clothes.
And his weird clothes.
And his long hair.
You know, and you know, during this time he was also teaching classes over Italy and over Switzerland during the weekdays, and was getting to know
what kind of classes?
Theology, and he was a minister, and that's what he did. And anyway, he learns firsthand. These students that he has are really his tutors, if you will, because they are in the university system, and they are learning European existential thought, you know, during the 1950s. And so he is looking and he's seeing what it is they're saying that they're learning, but also he is becoming aware and seeing very clearly the fruit, the dead end of the way that line of thinking is, which is, you know, drugs, dropping out, no purpose in life. And he sees this, and he's like, you know, we really do have the answer.
This wasn't a real formal Bible study kind of thing. One of the stories that Francis tells is how after 3 years of sponsoring these little weekend discussion groups, you know, a lot, these are Christian, non-Christian, drug-using, non-drug-using, anybody is invited that just wants to discuss ideas. But he says, you know, after 3-4 years of this, the curtains are trashed, the carpet is gone, you know, there's vomit in the kitchen floor. I mean, the place
is... Cigarette burns in the furniture.
Gosh. You invite hundreds of guests over a period of months to your house.
Yeah.
Guess what happens? But this is interesting because it also characterizes a very, very tough time for Francis and Edith as husband and wife. The pressure is mounting. You invite that many guests, and Frankie, their son, is sick, and a lot of things are happening. Plus, Edith is really struggling because she sees that Francis is being called to something a little bit bigger. And she's really wrestling against the idea of him, you know, going off in these long lecture tours. And she's very frank about it. She says, gosh, I didn't want that. I was being selfish. I just wanted to have my home and my husband and everything to be cool.
But Francis was fired up.
Oh, you know, boy.
He was realizing with his reading, listening to the questions of college-age students, he wanted to get out there. Not in a way of aggrandizing his ego. He just realized that, you know, I need to share this with a broader audience than just the few people that can make their way up here to LaBrie.
Oh, and Time and Newsweek, everybody's starting to talk about LaBrie
now. He's starting
now.
To get known. LaBrie actually, by 1960, had to be made into a formal study system where they had full-time students all week long. They stayed 2 to 3 months. And they had to do that because they could never accommodate all the people that wanted to come in a merely weekend-oriented mm-hmm. thing. So eventually, Francis and his wife, they had a great strain upon their marriage. But eventually, she relents and says, go ahead and do this thing. And in the end, Francis is speaking at some of the world's leading colleges and universities and sharing his message with
now,
those people.
And the evangelical community is just freaking out. They don't know what to make of this.
Because he doesn't look like them.
Well, he doesn't look, not only does he not look like them, but he's just straight orthodox. I mean, mm-hmm. Verbal plenary inspiration. The Bible is completely inspired and trustworthy. All the answers to man's problems are going to be found in the Bible. And the fact that you can engage the culture, you know, as I say, he didn't spend his time thumping the Bible. He spent his time looking, well, look at what's happening in art. Look at what happens in the theater. You know, look at where the philosophers, where their lives take them and how they end their lives in despair and suicide and insanity. And so people were unaccustomed to the freedom of examination that he was bringing to the evangelical community. In the 60s, Mark Knoll and Chuck Holson, a bunch of guys
talk
that were
about
blown
their,
away.
Yeah, they said their lives were literally set on fire by his lectures because they were so different and so refreshing. Well we've got to move on, obviously, because we're painting.
Oh, no, I want to
go
right
into
here.
Minutia and great detail about these things. But rather, we need to move on, if we're painting really a broad portrait of Francis Schaeffer, to the last years of his life from the mid-70s until he died in 1984. And this is the era in really which we call him his prophetic ministry, because it really does take on tone. He himself is very widely known now the entire world over, and it's at this time that he actually is involved in Washington politics. Michael Ford, one of the sons of then-President Gerry Ford, had been one of his students at LaBrie, and Schaeffers were invited to the White House. They had forged ties with people in the Senate and the House of Representatives as far as challenging them to bring Christianity into politics. And Schaeffer also gets an idea about doing a film series, a 10-part film series called How Should We Then Live, which is basically a chronicling of the rise and fall of Western thought and culture from a Christian perspective. And this becomes just a very, very widely viewed work. It received a lot of criticism from within LaBrie and from without, just because it did paint things in such broad brush strokes. And yet, on the other hand, many evangelicals hearken back to that as something that fired them up to get involved in politics, which evangelical Christians are known for even as of this last election. This was some of the seeds of that was being sown in the 70s.
Frankly, it's the primary, one of the primary texts that we use in our history class, and I know that it's been formative in kind of goosing me to, boy, really go after and challenge myself academically, as historically, philosophically, examining the things that I believe, examining, you know, what I understand about my role as a citizen and as a member of this culture. It was a masterwork, and it really did. It revolutionized the evangelical community's perception of what they do. And how they live in the culture. Now, he began to focus after that, after how should we then live, he began to focus on abortion and its importance as an issue, and wrote a book with then Surgeon General Koop about abortion. He was a little disappointed because the evangelical community was still kind of hedging their bets, and they weren't really trying to tackle abortion. And so he also wrote,
The Christian Manifesto, and then his last work is The Great Evangelical Disaster,
that's right.
Both of which were sharply criticized, and yet, interestingly enough, if you read those books, you realize virtually everything that he predicted in those books.
The rise of postmodernism, the pluralism,
And yet people thought he was really being harsh and over the edge at the time. And yet,
here we are today.
He saw the future, and here we are in those books.
Ironically enough, he dies in 1984.
So he never
got to see it.
And it's quite an amazing thing. Well, LaBrie is, if we talk about the legacy of Francis Schaeffer for just a minute, LaBrie is still around. There is a LaBrie in the United States. There is a LaBrie in six other countries around the world. People still go there, still study. Obviously, Francis Schaeffer is listened to on tape as opposed to being there in person. All of his children, minus Frankie, are involved in the LaBrie ministry in some way, their family, their husband serving there, and that's still a living thing. And then, of course, how then should we live, I think, is, once again, a real contribution that Francis Schaeffer...
Every Christian should read that book.
The book or see the film series.
Or see the film series.
It's probably... I first saw it 12 years ago, and I thought it was outdated, and we went through it a couple of church history class and found that it was actually prophetic. It wasn't outdated at all. It actually tells where we're at today. It's a very real thing. And then, of course, Francis Schaeffer's many writings. What a legacy left there.
Who could read all that Francis Schaeffer wrote?
Oh, I did.
Well, okay, fine.
But anyway, it was only like 18 or 19. Once again, his books, why are they important to us today, is they take very, very complex philosophical and theological debates from the 20th century and boil them down and describe them in a way that's accessible to most Christians.
And boy, that was his major gift, is he took what the academic community holds on to so tightly and makes it accessible to common Christianity. And that is really what he says is crucial for us to do. We must engage the culture. We must remain orthodox, but we don't have to bow down to conformity. We can be who we are, but hold on to orthodoxy. And we have to learn to think, to use our minds, and to engage the culture we're a part of. That's the only way our art will be authentic, and it's the only way we will change the culture for the better.
You guys, thanks for doing Francis Schaeffer today. And I suppose it's true, if you grasp the current of the river of Christianity for the last 2,000 years, you have a good sense of the direction where it's going, and rather than us just studying the next rock in the stream, you look down and said, you know what, this river is going there, unless we build a dam here.
Exactly.
So, great, guys. Thanks for doing it.
You bet.
We like to do it.
Yeah. Matt McAuliffe and Chris White, teachers of church history at Pacific Bible College, and friends, and once a month you can hear them. What's next month, guys? Do you know?
Revivals and tent meetings. We're going to talk about the movement of revivals and tent meetings in the United States of America. So,
I think anticipate a little Finney coming up here.
Well, I'm sitting there thinking, give me that old-time religion. That's what I'm hearing.
All right. Well, it's 25 minutes before 1 o'clock. Speaking of just thinking, we got Ravi Zacharias in about 10 minutes, and then we have Focus on Faith here on KDUF. Stay with us.
A portion of today's programming is